Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today, we're bringing you a show highlighting stories about creatives in Hawaii who have picked up some big awards in recognition of the work they do. This month, Kumuhula Vicky Holtakamini was honored with the Gish Award, named for silent screen actress Lillian Gish. It comes with a check of close to $500,000. Last year, the MacArthur Foundation honored another Kumuhula for his innovative work on the continent. We can thank Patrick Makuakane for his transformative hula. His halau marks its 40th year in 2025. And two local filmmakers tackle queer history in Hawaii. A prestigious Humanities Monuments Grant will allow them to share hidden histories through projects crossing cultures. It's Thursday, December 26th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we celebrate the arts and those in our community who are at the top of their game. We sat down with Kumuhula Vicky Holtakamine, who was just celebrated at Washington Place. She was honored with a prestigious award that previously had never been presented to anyone outside of New York. This year, Auntie Vicky brought her halau back to Mary Monarch after some 40 years. Listen as Halau Pua Ali'i Alima takes the stage. When Takamini joined us in our studios, she told us the news of the Gish Award caught her completely by surprise.
So I was in shock when somebody called and said, "Hi, you've been awarded the Lillian Gish Prize." And then I immediately started to Google it on my phone. I was like, "Lillian Gish Prize? I'd never heard of it before." I said, "Oh, did I apply for this? I don't remember applying for anything." Then I found out, oh, she's a silent movie actress. I was like, I don't even know her, you know, from the 1920s. And so black and white movies. I said, I remember black and white movies. I'm that old. But I said, I didn't apply. She says, oh, no, you don't apply. You get nominated. So they sent out invitations to 100 people nationwide to submit a name to be considered for the Lillian Gish Prize. And then they select 5 individuals to come into their office in New York and sit around the table and review all the nominations. And the team selects the prize winner for the year.
And you were just recently honored at Washington Place. We understand Governor Josh Green says that you have really put Hawaii on the map with this, because prior to this, nobody outside of New York had won it.
That's right. Nobody outside in the 31 years that this prize has been given, no one outside of New York has received it. So the artists that are on this list, if you Google Lillian Gish Prize, they're amazing artists. It's Merce Cunningham, it's Spike Lee, it's famous people. And for the first time in the history of this prize, someone from Hawaii, Kumuhula, whose art form is hula, and from Hawaii, has been nominated and won. I was just in tears when Terrence McKnight, who is actually on public radio, he has a show, he does classical music on NPR, but he's the chair of the selection committee for this year. And I was like, are you kidding me? I said, how is that possible? you know? He says, we only give one prize annually, and this was the mission, and this is what Lillian Gish had wanted, to give one artist annually a prize, a cash prize. When he told me, he says, well, depends. This is very casual, like, depends on when the check is cut. I said, first, he says, you've won the Lillian Gish prize. I said, I'm so excited, but I said, I don't know how I got here. Because I looked on their website. I don't know anybody on their website. Usually you would know somebody, like a program officer or someone. I knew no one on their website. I didn't know anybody on the committee. I researched the committees. I researched the artists. I don't know anyone personally that would recommend me. And so he says, well, you were nominated. You were among 100 people. And we all got in the room. And of course, your name was the last one on the list.
Wow.
Because we go alphabetically. And so Takamine was the last one. And we got to this Victoria Holt Takamine. And it's like, Okumu Hula. And so they started to, they said, well. So they, by then, they had gone through 99 other names. And they each brought in their top six or so, the five. So they had 30 to be tossed around and then ended up with myself and someone else. I don't know who it is, but, and they debated for about an hour and a half and they decided that I would get it.
So what was it like then? I mean, you flew out there and were interviewed and?
No, not at all. That was it. That was it. So he says, I'm going to come over because since you're in Hawaii and everybody else has been in New York, I'm going to come over and present you with a silver medal. And I said, you mean like an Olympic medal? Like I won, I came in second place or something. He says, you came in first. I was like, really? It's like, I said, I've got a silver medal. I should have brought it for you to see. And then this is what he tells me. He says, and depending on when the check is cut, I said, oh, I get a check too. I'm thinking like, yay, anywhere between $400,000 and $500,000. I said, you have got to be kidding me. I mean, how is that possible? The largest one that I know of is like $50,000 for the United States Artist Fellows. I don't know anybody that has had that. You know, it's like the lottery that you didn't play. You didn't put any skin in the game. I was like in shock. So, yeah.
And so are there strings attached with this award?
No, I thought it was going to go to Pa'i. I said, oh, this money, he's going to Pa'i. He says, no, not to your nonprofit. It goes to Vicky Holt Takamine. I said, oh, I have to pay taxes on that too now. Yeah, so we're figuring that out right now and then figuring out how I can leverage that for, you know, Pa'i. And
well, you know, I mean, I recall going to the fashion shows, you know, that you have put together there in Waikiki. And that is just a stunning visual event. And I remember going there for the first time. And it was just like, yes, it just celebrates the creativity in this community. And, you know, you've done so many things, you know, with your halau and Mary Monarch and, you know, your contribution to hula and mele and oli. And it's just so nice to see Hawaii's talent acknowledged for their contributions.
I was like, can I ask you who nominated me? And this is what I think what is very important for our listeners is while we do a lot of good work here in Hawaii, that work has to get out across because nobody would have nominated me that's on their committee or that would have been invited to if I wasn't going to New York or going to Jackson, Mississippi, or going to South Dakota or going to Minneapolis. So it's the work that I not only do here, but I do on the continent and bring to Hawaii. So my art space lofts, for example, that we built 84 units of artist housing, rental for artists to live, work, and play in, that we built in Kaka'ako. It took me 15 years to get that project up and running. We had to raise $55 million for that. We've got 84 units of artist housing and affordable housing for Hawaii. I was just talking to the educators, State Department of Education, and I should go talk to our governor as well mm-hmm. and some of our state ledge because we need housing for teachers. They have housing for teachers in other states. But if we want to keep good quality teachers here in Hawaii, then we have to provide them spaces to live. So I'm thinking that's one of the things that we need to start to advocate for is teacher housing, housing for health care, the real resources that we need to make Hawaii affordable and livable for the people of Hawaii. so that they can provide the kinds of services that we actually really need in Hawaii.
Right. So we can keep the kumuhulas, you know, here.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But even our regular teachers that teach school, that teach elementary school and high school, that is so valuable for the education of our kids, we need to keep them home so that they can teach our own kids here and not have to ship them off to the continent, you know.
Well, I remember when the artist space, when that project came up before the Hawaii Community Development Authority, you know, those HCDA meetings, you know, and at the time it was like, wow, this is a really interesting idea, you know, and then to see it actually come to fruition is just beautiful.
Because it is a model that I think that we can adapt and adopt for Hawaii. And not. And I told our art space president, Kelly Lindquist, we need one on every island, one on every moku, to help not just artists, but educators and more of our community. That's the kind of thing. Is I went to Minneapolis to go get funding to get this project done. I've been in New York to meet with funders at Ford and at Mellon and at Doris Duke to bring money here to Hawaii to serve our community. So we were talking earlier about our Mama Wearable Art Show, leveraging up our artists, making sure that they have a platform to showcase their art form. And also then we have an artist residency program. So we just sent Kanoe Davis from Molokai, another beautiful artist, to Santa Fe Indian Market. Go visit the Indian Market, see what's happening there. You need to experience things outside of Hawaii so you can bring it back here and then leverage your own business. We're doing a Native Professional Development Program for artists at Pa'i Foundation to help them leverage up their game.
I think, what do they say, rising tide lifts all ships?
Yes.
And when you see the artistry finally getting acknowledged on the continent, not just for what you do here for the local community, but what you do for all of the U.S.
Yes, look at Manaola. I mean, he's doing amazing things. Kahulalea, you know, they all started at our Mama Wearable Art Show. That was their introduction into fashion and design. So, yay.
Yeah, yeah, the synergy, yeah. So as you reflect back on your journey as an artist, and then just to know that you have gotten this like stamp of approval.
It's been really, for me, I'm really hopeful that it's uplifting the rest of our community, puts Hawaii on our map, puts Native Hawaiians on our map, puts our art form on the map, puts hula up there. We all recognize hula as one of the most prominent artistic practice here in Hawaii. But it doesn't get that kind of recognition across the continent. And so now, you know, what it means for me, like I often say, hula is a form of resistance. So it has helped to perpetuate our Hawaiian language. Because in the 70s, when I uniki fomenti maiki ayuleke as a kumu hula, the 70s is when we started our Hawaiian language immersion schools. Halau hula, kumu hula, then uniki. Around that time, all of us were just coming out of, we were all the flower children from the Vietnam War 60s, but graduating and, you know, getting into college and as a graduate of Auntie Mikey, helping to leverage Hawaiian students and Hawaiian language. So in hula, we perpetuate the Hawaiian language, even though that was banned. We perpetuate hula, even though that was banned. So hula has always been a form of resistance. And then, of course, you know, we got very active, politically active in the 1990s with the state legislature to advocate for protection of our traditional and customary gathering rights, the protection of Papahanao Moku Akea, the marine sanctuary for Mauna Kea, all of those issues, land and cultural resources for our people, but also helping tourism to really, I know it's our number one industry, but can you be more responsible? So pushing Hawaii Tourism Authority to open up funding for cultural practitioners so that if you're marketing our culture, what do you do to give back to our culture?
It's that art and activism.
I think that's what it is, you know, the recognition that who pushes our art form to the next level and creates social justice movements. So I think that that's what I've been involved in. You know, I pull from both sides of my family. My father's side is very political. you know, my brother Milton, my brother Daniel, they're all in politics. That's my dad's side. And then my mother's side was a hula dancer. She was the Alhoi queen. She was Auntie Mikey's queen. She was danced for Auntie Mikey Ayulake. And so the hula genealogy and the political side of it that kind of merged into, I'm the firstborn. I get to kind of use both sides to leverage everything that I'm passionate about. I never thought I would get into real politics, but I think that it's, for me, I my father has had a strong influence on me and my mother as well.
Yeah, it's under your skin?
Yep. I don't think we can get away from it.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your mana about, you know, this award and about the culture. And I don't know, any final thoughts, anything you want to share with young artists out there?
I hope I get asked to nominate somebody, because I'm just looking for that next person that can win this award too. I have been asked to nominate people in other like United States Artist Fellows at Taproot that's coming out soon. So I try and look for artists that are doing really, really good work and help to promote them. So I think that's what I'm hoping I get asked to. Nominate somebody.
Well, you've got your finger on the pulse. Well, mahalo. Thank you so much for
coming
by. Thank
you for inviting me here.
That was Kumuhula Vicky Holtakamini talking with us about winning the Lillian Gish Prize, which honors an individual who has made an outstanding contribution to the beauty of the world and to mankind's enjoyment and understanding of life. Established in 1994 through the will of Lillian Gish, this marks the first time we're told that the honor has gone to an artist outside of New York. Hulu 2025 marks the 40th anniversary of Nale Hulu'ikawekiu. The driving force behind the San Francisco-based Halau is Kumuhula Patrick Makuakane. Back in 2023, he was honored by the MacArthur Foundation for his contributions to the arts. Every year, the foundation selects a handful of people at the top of their field to support, from science to the arts. The award comes with a generous check, what some call the Genius Grant. Makuakane has won several Isadora Duncan Dance Awards and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the San Francisco Ethnic Dance Festival. This master teacher is celebrated for his innovation in elevating hula and Hawaiian culture. Makuakane's halau regularly performs at the Palace of Fine Arts in the city by the bay, as well as at the Burning Man Arts Festival in the desert. And that is where Makuakane recalls he got a time-sensitive text about his big win. Take a listen to the interview that we did with him last year.
All I got was a text message saying that you haven't returned our calls and we're trying to reach you. This is the MacArthur Foundation and calling you with a time-sensitive, confidential matter. And that came through as a text, because I didn't receive their calls. I'm in Burning Man. There is no cell service, really. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is the MacArthur Foundation calling me for? You know, and I never reached her. It took like days of calling back and forth and not getting in touch with her and her not getting in touch with me. Finally, like 5 days later, I got back to San Francisco and she told me why she was calling. I'm like, oh my God, what the hell? It was shocking.
Well, I had visions of you at Burning Man in the mud, you know, making mud angels because you were so thrilled at hearing the news, but you didn't really know until...
Yeah, but I didn't really know. So you try to like think, why isn't my MacArthur Foundation calling me? Am I kidding? I'm like, no, I can't be. I must owe them money. Do I owe them money? What's going on here? So I didn't really know, and it was frustrating. And walking in that mud, it's like your foot gets stuck with every step. I had to go back to camp and wrap my boots in plastic bags. It was crazy.
Yeah, usually Burning Man, you have dust in every orifice, but it's a little different this year.
It was a little different.
You got back home and then discovered you won.
A MacArthur Fellow. You know, it's like, might as well win an Oscar. How is this supposed to happen? How do they even know who I am and what I do? You know, it was baffling and just an incredible amount of gratitude. But it was a shocker.
Well, the pressure's on now, because I was thinking the last time we talked, you had just gotten a grant to do Mahu. And that show was spectacular. I mean, oh my goodness, just to have Mahu in San Francisco and then to have it come here. And it was such a wonderful production.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I was very happy with that. I was really, really just extremely pleased, especially with the Hawaii production. Every time I do a show here in San Francisco, we're very well received, and that's fortunate for us. But when I take it home to Hawaii, people get, you know, you can't help it. People get you in a way that they can never get it over here, because it's like it's that hometown idiosyncrasies that only us local people can understand, you know. So as much as people love it here, and they did, it's like back at home, it's like I'm home. I get to be with my people. And it's just an exciting opportunity. And to watch these transgender artists, I told them, I didn't want you to be background musicians for dancers. I wanted you to be forefront and center and tell your stories, but not the freaking encyclopediac version. Like, bring it down, Wikipedia. You guys talk too much. Our show was supposed to be 50 minutes first half and 50 minutes second half. Was an hour and a half and like an hour and 20 minutes. I'm like, ladies,
it was,
bring it down.
It was so heartfelt and very powerful. You know, and I recalled when we had talked a few years ago, you were planning to do something on the cruise lines, and then the pandemic hit.
And so that got stopped, but then we went in plannings again, not for a cruise line, for another opportunity. And yeah, so we're still working on that and seeing what happens.
But what do you do with $800,000, Patrick? Wow.
You know, this is so funny, because I dipped my toes in the waters, a possibility, and then I take them out really fast. Then I dip them again and take them out really fast. It's like I decided to let myself just enjoy this time of being in a fellow and not worry about what I'm going to do with the money. And I'll just let that happen naturally. So the only thing that I really thought about so far was this will enable me to engage in opportunities and collaborations with fellow Native Hawaiian artists whose work that I really admire and that inspire me. And I would love to support what they do. And, you know, and it's a collaboration. So I get I get a lot of inspiration and art making out of that collaboration as well. So it's a win-win for both of us. And they're really some wonderful people that I can't wait to share their artistry with the world.
For folks who don't know, this is not the type of fellowship that you apply for. You can't apply for this grant.
No, right. You have to be nominated, and we don't know how the nomination process is. We have no idea who nominated us. I know that there's a strong vetting process that happens after you're nominated, but you have no idea. That's why when they call people, it's a shocker, because you didn't apply for it. You have no idea if you get a call. And you know what's sweet is when we got together with the other fellows and the foundation the other day on Zoom, the MacArthur Foundation kept telling us how this is their favorite day the whole year to finally meet everyone. And because the joy, the jubilance is so palpable. It's just incredible.
Yeah, off the charts, I can imagine.
Yeah. How can you not be? And I have to say, you know, there are people in here who are nuclear physicists and mathematicians and social justice and environmental work. Things are really important to, like, shifting our world to making it a better place. And then there's hula. And you know what? Hula does the same thing. It's just as important as all those other disciplines. And that makes me really, really proud. Proud of hula, proud of my culture, and thankful to all my kumu and my ancestors. It's really an award. I know people say this all the time. It's more than me. It's more than people. But it truly is in my case. I say it takes a village to raise a kumu.
And, you know, to think, really, by you getting this honor, you honor them.
Yes, absolutely. And I couldn't have done it without them. I mean, there's so many people on whom I stand on the shoulders of so many people, and I cannot even express the gratitude that I have to the countless of people who have helped to get me to this point where I am today. And really to San Francisco, who provided me a place where I felt unshackled, but yet always grounded by Hawaii. I've never felt once that I was apart from home. I've always felt tethered to the mothership, so to speak. But being here in San Francisco, which is really a city that celebrates expression and art and also funds you in a way that Hawaii never could. You know, that's the other thing. It's the funding here, once you tap into the system, is extraordinary. If you have work that's, you know, proves to be something that people want to see, that has an aesthetic appeal. And I think for us, because we have this tradition as well as this contemporary outlook, people really appreciate that. And I'm currently trying to reframe this conversation around tradition as something that's stuck and mired in a certain place and time, you know, as a static symbol of heritage and culture, because tradition is really, it's not. It's dynamic. It changes. It shifts with the environment. And in order for us to be vibrant and culturally relevant, things have to change over time. And I recognize how innovative our ancestors were. And even the hula ancestors, when you look back at all the old hula that we don't have today, I mean, there was so much innovation in the art form. And it makes me look like a kindergartner dancing hula. Please, people think I'm innovative. They should look back at all these other hulas that our ancestors were teaching and crafting.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, would this grant help you expand your reach? You know, because I was thinking of the Mahu show and, you know, gosh, if you could travel.
Yeah, it would. I mean, I would love to take Mahu on the road. It does. It deserves to be seen that way. So it can. It can do that. And the other thing I loved, because we were really well-funded in San Francisco for the Mahu show. Out of the 20 years that we've been applying for our home season, Mahu was the most funded out of all of them, because it really resonated with organizations. Because at the time, there was a lot of, there was a national discussion about trans rights and the vitriol that was thrown against this community. So people really felt that this was an important show. And my point with Mahu was not to go out there on stage with a rallying cry and a strident call for justice. It was like, you know what? All I have to do is let them sing, dance, tell their stories, and be their authentic selves. And after that's over, how can you not deny them their humanity and a seat at the table? Because they are such extraordinary people that you would want them there, because they belong there. They make us better. And of course, I'm preaching to the choir at San Francisco.
Well, the art is just so uplifting. And, yeah. You know, your productions, I think, are brilliant. If I can throw my two cents in there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, so I would love to share my talented Mahu friends with the world.
So I guess you're just going to massage this then to figure out, where do you go from here?
Yeah, and then I'm been sort of like mired in several different projects. I'm doing that Hiyaka play, and I'm also going to be directing an opera in 2026 for the Hawaii Opera Theater about Hawaiian patriot Timoteo Haʻaliʻiliʻo. It will be the first opera put on by HOT, the Hawaii Opera Theater, in ʻōlelo Hawaii, in Hawaiian language. And I am super excited and privileged to be working on that production.
Wow. So yeah, lots of things you've got to get off your to-do list before you can figure out then where else you go,
right,
with this MacArthur
grant. Yeah, right, exactly.
You're
yeah,
a busy so man.
It's a good problem to have.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I don't know. Anything else you want to share with your audience?
Yes, I have something kind of really super freaking awesome
what?
To tell you. So one of our signature pieces is we dance a hula to Roberta Flack's First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. And we performed it with Roberta Flack many years ago because she saw a YouTube clip of us dancing. And her manager is from Hawaii. So that's how the connection was made. Long story short, this last year, December, I read online that Roberta Flack had ALS and she couldn't sing anymore. And I called her manager to say, oh my God, and just to offer my support and condolences. I was just really heartbroken to hear about that. And her manager told me that, yeah, she has a breathing tube. She can't speak. She has a feeding tube. The only way she can communicate is by looking at you and holding your hand. And she goes, the only thing right now that really sort of gives her support and life and light is art. Her friends come over to her place to either sing or play for her. And that's what really gives her, sustains her, you know, to make this life livable. And I'm like, wow. Then she asked, by the way, are you going to be in New York in the next month? I'm like, Suzanne, if you're asking me if I would be willing to perform for Roberta Flack, just freaking tell me that date and I'll be there. So I took six dancers. We performed in Roberta Flack's home for an audience of one in her living room. And there were a few other people there, but for us, we did a 30-minute set for Roberta Flack. And it was just one of the most memorable things we've ever done at the Harlem. Blew me away.
Well, Patrick, that story is so powerful because I just mentioned Roberta Flack's situation because we had just talked with our general manager, Jose Fajardo, who has ALS. And many people don't know, you know, what you go through when you're struggling with this.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah. So I thank you for sharing that story about Roberta Flack. And
well, you're very welcome. Yeah. You know, someone who is like, the last chapter of their life is like coming upon them, and yet they're not going to lie down and go quietly. They still want to like enjoy whatever last vestiges of light and art that they can. And I just, what a way to like approach life. I hope that I'm that strong when my time comes.
Well, we thank you for your time. We thank you for your art, for your talent, for what you do, for those special moments that you share with us, you know, whether with someone like Roberta Flack or, you know, with the crowd, you know, with the Mahu Productions. Thank you for what you do, Patrick.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for the conversation, and I hope you have a great day.
All right, you too. Okay. Aloha.
Aloha.
That was Patrick Makuakane Kumuhula, who was selected as a 2023 MacArthur Foundation Fellow. The prize comes with an $800,000 grant over a five-year period and honors creativity and innovation. This interview originally aired in October 2023. And we should note that at the time, our former general manager, Jose Fajardo, was in the throes of ALS. He lost that battle earlier this month.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes.
As we reflect on the last year, we're reminded that independent journalism is the oxygen of a healthy democracy. Hawaii Public Radio brings you nuanced reporting and analysis of the complicated news happening in Hawaii and around the world. HPR listeners provide the largest share of our funding, so this moment matters. Start the new year strong with a monthly gift to HPR. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Sexual diversity in Hawaii is part of our history, from marriage equality in recent political times to acknowledgement of Mahu voices in Native Hawaiian culture. Now those stories are about to be told on a wider scale. It's thanks to a grant from the Mellon Foundation. The award is close to $1 million over a three-year period and will include stories from Hawaii's immigrant communities. The project is called Le Pua'ala, Queer Histories of Hawaii. It builds on a recent production by filmmakers Joe Wilson and Dean Hamer. Kapai Mahu is the story of the Healing Stones in Waikiki, a monument to spirits that were both male and female. The filmmakers teamed up with cultural practitioner Hinale Moana Wong Kalu to tell that story. Here's a clip from that animated film.
Papaya kula, anohoi uluko ma Waikiki. A oia mau malihini, heu I kanaka leo maliu. A he nono he waipahe no nae. daane a ole he wahine. He mau mahu lako. He pālua noho i lako makana au me ka no ono'o a mana anoa pau.
You know, we are re-airing an interview from earlier this spring when we invited Joe Wilson and Dean Hamer to our studio to talk about this latest project.
I think with Kapai Mahu, what was really impressive to us was the importance of having a place and a site, a physical place where people could go and they could see themselves reflected, because that's so rare. When you walk around Honolulu or any place, really, you don't see statues to gay people. You don't see monuments or markers that talks about the LGBTQ community. So having these ancient stones that do celebrate gender fluidity and that are a place a kid can go to or his family can go to or a school troop can go to, that was really amazing. So it made us think, wow, it'd be great if we had more places like that and more reflections for lots of different people.
Yeah, so you have the book, you had the exhibit at the museum. And I just love the way the film told the story of time, how it just rippled, you know. I guess knowing that you've got this project behind you, you're trying to build on it.
Yes, and I think I like the reference you're making to the film, and I think the section you're talking about is where in the animation it rapidly shows the big changes that were happening in Hawaii, primarily late 19th century and through the 20th century, with more and more foreigners here and the development that was happening and therefore the societal changes along with it. And I think what this project aims to do, as Dean said, having learned about the importance of representation and visible representation, in this case of a culture accepting of gender and sexual diversity, we started to ask ourselves while we were doing that project, what of all of the other histories of all of the other cultures and ethnicities that now comprise society in Hawaii? All the people who came throughout the years, plantation workers, others who were brought here or came here of their own volition seeking a life. What was life like for them, for same gender loving folks in the plantation era, for example, or people who had a diverse gender experience? And as Hawaii was changing, we want to understand what their lives were like as well. And this project aims at trying to bring some of those hidden histories forward.
And so you have this 3-year grant. What's the first step?
The first step is just to research some of the stories which have been hidden for so long. And one of the ones that we've been really fascinated with is the story of The Glade, which is this nightclub that was in Chinatown. That was maybe one of the first places that had big drag shows, or female impersonators, as they were called at the time. And it was also a time when there was still a lot of prejudice, even here in Hawaii. Some of the performers, who were biologically male but performed as females, had to wear little buttons that said, "I am a boy." It sounds really atrocious now, but it was a place that became a real center for community and for protection in the face of all of this prejudice. So that's one of the examples of the stories we've been researching, and then we're going to hopefully mark that by actually having that become a historical site. So that's the type of work that we're doing.
And I think another aspect of this project for us in our film work, our prior film projects, it was kind of a small team, you know, like us with Hina and then the various people that we needed for editing or animating, et cetera. This is a project that aims to have a much larger scope. And so one of the first things we did was to think about how do we build a larger team of people, a more diverse team of people that can and should be involved in this kind of work. So we were really lucky to partner with the Hawaii Council for the Humanities in the writing of the grant, in envisioning what the scope or the framework would be, and then bringing a lot of different people on. And scholars, DeSoto Brown, the historian from the Bishop Museum, is involved. Kumu Patrick Makua Kane is going to compose an original hula that brings the story of Kapai Mahu to life live, and it's going to be performed somewhere near the stones on the beach for visitors and locals alike to see history come alive. And that's really the goal of this project, I think, is that storytelling is really important. Storytelling is how people see and learn about the community around them and see themselves in the community. And this is going to have multiple forms of expression.
Well, the last time I talked to Patrick, I think he had just gotten the MacArthur Grant, and he was talking about the opportunity to be able to collaborate. So I guess this is a perfect example of something like that.
It's really a great collaboration, and he had seen the Kapai Mahu animation, and that was incorporated into his work. And so the opportunity now to come here to Hawaii and perform it where the Kapai Mahu actually are is something really extraordinary.
Well, you know, I have to smile because I remember seeing the two of you out and about town. Oh my gosh, I don't know, was it 10, 20 years ago? And you were doing the documentary, you know, with Hina. And then I think was the last time we talked was on the other film, Ladies in Waiting,
exactly,
yes,
about Tonga.
That was another wonderful production. And so I can't wait to see what you come up with this project.
Yeah, I mean, you reference projects that have been really important to us because in all of those projects, we were able to do what we intend to do here, which is work with people at the grassroots community level who have an interest in either sharing their own stories or, in this case, you know, kupuna and memory holders who have memories that are deep within of what their experiences were or people that they knew of the generation before them, on the kinds of issues related to what it's like to be Mahu in Hawaii or what it was like in different periods, or using some of the language we use today, LGBTQ. How did people survive? How did people pursue their goals and their dreams in a society that may not have been welcoming and in many cases was quite harsh and punitive and forced people to suppress themselves and to hide and to not have opportunities that many other people have?
So when you do your research, I mean, will you go back to, I don't know, the Hawaiian language newspapers and see what was written or not written?
We're doing all types of research, and not just in the Hawaiian language newspapers, but also in the Chinese and Japanese newspapers. People sometimes forget that they have their own cultures that have same-sex experience and gender-fluid experiences. For example, all during the plantation era, there were Chinese opera troupes and there were Japanese opera troupes that came and played at the plantations and that often featured males playing female parts because that was part of their culture. And so there's a lot of fascinating history there as well. And of course, we're also so interested in talking to people because so many of these histories are not in the newspaper. They're at best in the police records and in people's memories. And so that's why it's really important for folks to share these now, where we are much more open and we'll be able to preserve them and to carry them on for generations.
That was Dean Hamer and Joe Wilson, who have been awarded a $900,000 grant to document queer histories in Hawaii, including immigrant stories from plantation days. It aims to include historical markers, performances, and workshops. We'll have more of our conversation with Hamer and Wilson right after this break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Tune into HPR 2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony performs Tchaikovsky's Pathétique. Also featured mezzo-soprano Fleur Baron weaves a magical spell with Lieberson's Neruda songs. This special concert is dedicated to the memory of Michael Titterton, longtime president of HPR and later HSO. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Let's get back to our interview with Dean Hamer and Joe Wilson. They're teaming up with the Hawaii Council of Humanities, along with historian DeSoto Brown, Kumuhula Patrick Makuakane, and cultural practitioner Hinalei Moana Wongkalu, for a project documenting queer history in Hawaii. So is this basically an open call, like, hey, if there's anybody out there who has a memory about this time?
The queer auntie, the queer uncle,
yeah.
Or their friends, or the ones you knew about. Yes, it is an open call, and we'd love to hear more from people that like to share their experience.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that is one of the main intentions. You know, we're in the early stages now, so we're just starting to do outreach, talking to university groups and kapuna groups and one-on-one conversations with a lot of people across the islands, actually, because this is not only Oahu. This is across the islands. So on our website, which is queerhistoriesofhawaii.org, we do invite people to think about what kinds of stories could and should be shared, whose lives and experiences should be highlighted, what kind of places used to serve at times when people weren't welcome openly in the community, what kind of gathering places where they were. We want to create a whole landscape that reveals what community life was like under the surface for people like us, essentially. And there's one other element that I think is really important. So in addition to community input and community sharing, we also are operating under the premise that wherever histories are told and histories are shared, queer history should be included. So we're having wonderful conversations, for example, with the Hawaiian Historical Society and the Mission Houses and the Japanese Cultural Center and Hawaii's Plantation Village and the Judiciary History Center and Bishop Museum and on, all the places locals and visitors go to learn about history. Our history should be more visible there. And this project is aimed at helping to make sure that we can help those with content and curators who want to program stories like this.
Yeah, so whether it's the Filipino community, the Okinawan community,
Senator Inoue and the Japanese American community, people sometimes who were great allies and great supporters, that was not always emphasized in their biographies because, you know, you're not sure. But now is the time for that to come out more clearly. So we're working with groups like the Inoue Institute, for example, to make sure that his contributions, which were very significant, are recognized.
Right. And I'm sure you'll include the histories of the gay marriage legislation here in Hawaii.
That's marriage, of course, is perhaps our most well-known contribution because Hawaii is the birthplace of same-sex marriage. It all started at the Bladesdale Hotel up in Chinatown, and that's a wonderful story. But we'll also be sharing stories like the fact that that wasn't the first same-sex marriage in Hawaii. There was actually two plantation workers who got married back in
1920. Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories. As we start to dig through, because there is a lot of information out there, you just have to dig and dig and dig. So in a 1920 newspaper, the Pacific Commercial Advertiser, I think it was called, there was a picture of a couple that was married in this big article on the headline proclaiming that two people are arrested, one masquerading as a woman, a man masquerading as a woman. So they're humiliated publicly on the front page of this 1920 paper. What's beautiful about this story, when we ask these questions, what was life like for plantation workers in those times? Well, here's a Filipino couple, Florencio Loriozzo and Benita Ocho, who got married in 1920 at a church. In the newspaper article, the reverend is named. And after they got married, someone in the neighborhood reported them to the police and said, oh, that's not a man and a woman, that's two men, one masquerading as a woman. So they were arrested, detained. Benita's hair was cut, and she was forced to put on man's clothing, and then they were deported to the Philippines. So that's a sad story, but it has a good ending.
According to records, 2 years later, they returned to Hawaii, and now they had children with them. So apparently they were trusted enough in their own community that people were willing to send their children with them to Hawaii, to the promised land. We don't know what happened after that, but it's certainly a lovely story. And it just is one more example of how this whole idea of LGBT and gay marriage and stuff, it's nothing new. It's something that people have been wanting to do, thinking about, and actually doing for a long, long time.
And a story like that highlights, for me at least, what it was, people who were being incredibly brave and courageous in challenging times. And probably because of their visibility, they were offering hope and inspiration to others around them.
I just think of a line from a show that we had today about celebrating history and culture. And that's what sounds like what this project is going to do.
That's the aim, yeah. And really to show that you know, the big sweeping aspects of history are obviously important, but we want to reveal the everyday people who are involved in making such, you know, in the case of Hawaii, positive change possible. You know, ups and downs, two steps forward, one step back, you know, occasional backlash, but it has been good, and we want to reveal some of those things here, and we've already got a number of exciting stories.
So is the idea that you take the first year, do some research, and roll a project out, and then do some more research, and build on that?
Yes, exactly. It's a continuous process, and I think what we found even from Kapai Mahu is that the more we learn and the more we platform and talk about and get these stories out, the more we learn because the more people become interested. So Hawaiian scholars now are sharing with us stories about aikane relationships, same-sex intimate relationships, from some of the great chiefs of Hawaii Island, for example, and we'll be recognizing those as well.
And I think we want to look, too, at what are the best ways to make these stories visible. So we'll be working with community, doing talk stories to say, and this is very directly related to the Mellon Foundation, which provided the three-year grant for this. So the Mellon Foundation created something called the Monuments Project, and that emerged out of the murder of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, which was asking questions about, you know, the landscape, in this case, of Confederate monuments that show the oppressors in the community, but not representations of, you know, the vast diversity of our communities. So they created the Monuments Project as a way to ask community groups, grassroots efforts, to say, what should visibility of underrepresented groups look like?
Right. What are we
community?
Missing?
Yeah. So our history project is aimed at asking that question. How should Mahu and LGBTQ and queer histories be more visible across the landscape? We'll be thinking about public art. We'll be thinking about performances and spoken word and poetry and academic articles and who knows, maybe monuments or gathering places. All these things that say we too should be visible in the landscape every day, just like everyone else.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
And I can't wait to see what you come up with.
It's going to be fun.
And that was Dean Hamer and Joe Wilson, who are in the early stages of a project documenting queer histories in the islands. They are building on the success of the Kapai Mahu project. It included an animated film, book, and museum exhibit telling the story of healing stones and spirits, which were both male and female. The stone monument stands today at the edge of Waikiki and will be incorporated in this latest project, Le Pua'ala Queer Histories of Hawaii. Check out their website. That does it for today's special showcase of our awards on Oahu. We have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear more about the recovery plan for Maui, which was just released this week. The conversation is available as a podcast on Apple or Spotify or on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.